Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. This week, the Santa Fe Opera is performing a different opera every night, so this week on the Radio Cafe, we're running our opera series with Desiree Mays, talking about the opera that's on stage tonight. I'd like now to introduce Desiree Mays. She's the author of Opera Unveiled, the book now in its 12th year that comes out every year to accompany the five operas of the Santa Fe Opera season. Desiree lectures nightly at the Preview Buffet of the Santa Fe Opera. She's an international lecturer and spends much of the winter season lecturing at the Metropolitan Opera in New York. And she's tour director of Act One Tours, which takes people all over the world to see opera. Welcome, Desiree, to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
We're talking today about the opera The Magic Flute by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. And this is an opera that Mozart wrote pretty much toward the end of his very short life.
Yes, he wrote it in 1791, which was the last year of his life. He only lived to the age of 36. It was an amazing year. It was a real struggle that year. He started the year out literally begging for funds from his fellow Mason brothers. He was out of funds, and his wife Constanze had a second son. This was the sixth of eight pregnancies. Only two children survived, which is devastating, I think. Can you imagine on the home front just dealing with that?
Right.
The fact that your wife has an eighth pregnancy, and this baby lived. They already had a seven-year-old, who I think was part of this whole magic flute phenomenon, if you like. The piece was to be a Singspiel, a play with music. The librettist Schikaneder, all he really wanted was Mozart to write incidental music for his play, this magic play about a magic flute. And that was the original idea, he would write music and the play would be the main thing. As time has gone on, of course, the recitative has dropped by the wayside. There's very little dialogue in the piece now. It's an opera. It really is. So this was conceived lightly. It turned out that the great librettist who had worked with Mozart, Lorenzo da Ponte, of the Marriage of Figaro, Don Giovanni, and Così van tutte, had a falling out with the emperor and had been sort of kicked out of court, never to return. He actually ended up here in New York, amazingly, teaching, and died in New York. But at this time, Mozart then was looking for a new opera, and Schikaneder, who was the actor-director of the Theater Auf dem Wieden, which is on the outskirts of Vienna, came and said, I need music for the Singspiel. Would you write it? So they got together to do it. It really appealed to Mozart because he liked to write in the vernacular, in German. That was his language. Whereas the language of the court was in Italian, and when he wrote court operas, he had to write in Italian. So this was really fun for him. It also meant he could have it performed out in this theater on the outskirts. It was an 800-seat theater that actually still exists. It has become very famous over the years because of Mozart. It was rebuilt, and actually Beethoven's Fidelio premiered there, the Merry Widow premiered there, many shows. And over the front portal, there's a statue of Schikaneder as the birdman, Papageno. So this is the opera they're writing. But in the middle of writing it, he gets a call from the emperor who says that he's going to be crowned in Austria, I think. And Mozart had to drop everything to go for the coronation. Not just that, he had to write an opera for this coronation, La Clemenza di Tito, which he did write in the middle of doing the magic flute.
Oh my goodness.
At the same time, an anonymous donor came to him and said, "Will you please write a requiem?" And he was so superstitious about this requiem because he believed it was to be his own, and he didn't know who the sponsor was. So he was very superstitious about that. He was very ill, and his wife had this drama. He was writing some exquisite music for his Masonic brethren. The Ave Verum comes from this period. So this is the last year of his life. The opera premiered on September the 30th in 1791, and he died that December. So it was. It's the grand finale, and
wow.
It's different to the others. This truly is a family piece. It's a fantasy piece. It's a playful piece. It's a fairy tale about a prince who chases a dragon. But he doesn't actually kill the dragon, as heroes are supposed to do. He faints instead. Silly things happen. There's a queen of the night who comes out of the darkness, and there are magical things. And there's a lot of musical props. Instruments that are integral to the piece is the magic flute itself. They're the magic bells, the pipes. The music is a very important character, if you like, in the piece.
Now, you mentioned a moment ago that Mozart was a Freemason, and mm-hmm. the magic flute has a lot of Masonic elements that you probably wouldn't figure out what they were unless you were briefed beforehand.
Yes, and at the time it was never accepted that this was the case. It was never spoken about because everything was so secret with the Masonic movement. The greatest thinkers of the day had been Masons, were Masons at the time of the Emperor Joseph II. But his successor became increasingly concerned that within the Masonic movement they were sowing the seeds of revolutionary ideas. Universal brotherhood, no class society. He was totally wrong, but he decided that he was going to clamp down, if not persecute, and actually get rid of the Masonic lodges in Vienna at the time. And I think the thinking now is that part of the reason that Schikaneder and Mozart, who were both Masonic brothers, that they looked at the deeper levels of this opera as a message of getting out the Masonic message of universal brotherhood, which is definitely there. And the opera shifts from time to time from pure, you know, fantasy, fairy tale stuff to very serious ideas and ideals. And I'm going to play a few tracks and maybe read the libretto to give you a sense of that, how it flip-flops back and forth. The two are not so seamless, and it's been criticized for this. But I think as you look at the overall picture, knowing there's an underlying agenda that at the time had to be kept secret, it gives a little more understanding to the work.
So why don't we start, as we have been doing all through this opera series, by talking a little bit about the story and introducing some of the characters.
Mm-hmm. Well, the opera starts with this prince who comes from nowhere, as all good princes in fairy tales do, a lost prince. And he finds this dragon and he faints. And when he comes to, here's this very strange-looking character who is a birdman. And this is Papageno. Papageno represents the simple people. He says to Tamino, the prince, that I work for the queen of the night. I catch birds for her, and she pays me. She gives me food and drink in exchange. So his first aria is really fun, and it follows a very serious opening. The opening of the opera has three strong chords that are representative of the Masonic, the Masons knocking on the doors, requesting admittance to the initiation ceremonies. And then suddenly we go from that serious note in the overture to this wonderfully fun aria by Papageno, who is a baritone. Der Vogelfanger bin ich ja. I am a birdcatcher. And actually, surprisingly, this piece is sung by Gerald Finley, who sang Batter My Heart when we talked about Life is a Dream. Let's hear that.
Bei Hart und Jung im ganzen Land. Ein Dätschen Mädchen möchte ich, ich finde sie gut und weiß für mich. Dann sperrte ich sie bei mir ein und alle Mädchen wären mein. Alle Mädchen wären mein, so tauschte ich Zucker ein. Die welche mir am liebsten wär, da geb ich gleich den Zucker her. Und küsst mir sie, ich werd mich dran, wär sie mein Weib und ich ihr Mann. Sie schlief an meiner Seite ein,
Der Vogelfänger bin ich ja. You know, what's interesting when you hear a recording of a live performance, there's all sorts of
bumps.
Stompings and bumpings,
yes, exactly.
And things like that. And yeah. Of course, the bird catcher, you hear the little flute bird-like sounds.
Yeah, that's right. And this recording actually is from a live performance at the Metropolitan Opera with Mary Dunleavy as the Queen of the Night, the Papageno we just heard, Gerald Finley, with Edo de Waard conducting the Met Opera Orchestra and Chorus. So we can talk about the other singers as we go through. So now, anyway, the prince comes too, and apparently, even within the Masonic ritual, there is a sense of fainting. He's fainting when the dragon appears, and this feint is part of that philosophy that you have to, it's almost like dying to be reborn. There's that sense as you leave behind your current life and take on the new life, as he is in fact doing at this point. He is shown a portrait of the princess, and he instantly falls in love with her, which always raises the question, is about what is he falling in love with. He hasn't met her yet, but he loves her portrait. But it's enough to get him going on the quest to find Pamina, who is the lost princess. She has been abducted, he is told, by the evil Zarastro, and that does not turn out to be the case at all. This is where there's a lot of flip-flopping in this opera. When we first meet the Queen of the Night, she's distraught because her daughter has been abducted, but she has another agenda. However, let's first listen to Pamino sing this aria when he is presented with the portrait of Pamina.
Dies Bildnis ist bezaubernd schön, wie noch kein Auge je gesehen. Mein Herz mit neuer Regung fühlt, mein Herz mit neuer Regung fühlt. Dies etwas kann ich nennen, doch fühl ich's mir wie Feuer brennen. Von die Empfindung, liebe sein, soll die Empfindung, liebe sein. Oh,
that's a little of Tamino, the prince in the magic flute. And now we need to meet Pamina. She has been abducted, and it is Papagena, not the prince, who finds her. And the two of them get together, and instead of fleeing from the dangerous place that she is supposed to be in, they sit and they sing a long duet, which is, of course, always what happens in opera. Remembering that at this time, of course, that Mozart was writing, he didn't change much, Mozart, but he was so extraordinary in developing the characters and making them, they could have been quite stock characters at that time period. He really develops, and this is done with the orchestration, the color in the music. And again, here you'll hear a little of the philosophy that's behind this very simple fairy tale. The two of them sit side by side. Pamina has been shown the portrait of the prince, and she, of course, then falls in love with him. In the break, we were talking about love at first sight, which
does happen.
Does happen. It really
Not
does.
Not to me, but to does. To, I have a very close friend who has been married to a woman for over 40 years, whom he saw across a crowded room and said, I want her.
You see, it can happen. That's amazing. Well, these two, now Pamina falls in love as well. And they sit, she and the birdman sit together and sing, the gentle love of man and woman shows humans are a race apart. It is woman's tender duty to give man her loving heart. When love is ours, we freely give. By love alone, we breathe and live. Now, this is interesting in this time period, because at this time, women were really treated as secondary beings. So they were supposed to be keep quiet and not chatter. And they were actually excluded from the Masonic movement because they did chatter and gossip. That was the belief. And actually, the Queen of the Night bears this out. Pamina doesn't. Pamina is the new generation. She is part, if you like, of the Enlightenment, of the changeover that was happening in Vienna at the time, with the whole of Europe, with the French Revolution. Everything was changing. The old ways were dying and the new were coming into being. And she, Pamina and Tamino, together, the noble couple, will be the two that ultimately resolve this story and move forward into the future, but not before they've been tested right, left, and center. So let's hear a little of this little hymn to marriage, I mean, of the wonders, of the joys of marriage, when it is shared on an equal basis, which was a pretty innovative idea and pretty innovative thinking for Mozart's time.
Now, do you think that that was something that Mozart lived in his own life?
Yes, I think so. I think reading his biographies, I think so. He respected, he loved women in all of his operas. His women are great.
But I mean, his wife in real life.
Oh yes, those two had fun. I mean, they had an incredible time. He was a little protective of her, a little critical. If she showed her ankle, he disapproved. You know, but he was writing her passionate love letters right to the end of their relationship. So it was he never. One thing about Mozart, he never made judgments. I mean, we talk about now, don't judge other people. Mozart
except
never
if your
judges.
Ankle's sticking out. Of course.
Well, that was a mild criticism. It's not quite the same thing, but. But his characters, he'll present them to you with their good and bad sides, and it's up to you to decide. But where women are concerned, he never judged. So let's hear a little of this duet, Pamina and Papageno.
Ist dann die Weiber, ist der Pflicht, wir wollen uns die Liebe freuen. Wir leben euch, die und neu. Kreise der Natur.
Zeit und Bahn.
And that's Pamina and Papageno's duet. Pamina in this recording is sung by Barbara Bonney and Papageno, did I say that? Papageno by Gerald Finley.
We're talking about The Magic Flute, one of the operas at the Santa Fe Opera this season. We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned. And we're with Desiree Mays today talking about The Magic Flute. Now, the title of the opera, The Magic Flute, let's talk about the flute.
At this time, there was a tradition called Zauberoper, magic operas, that took these little different themes, anything to do with the magic content, a fairy tale of some kind. And the magic flute is the one that they chose, obviously. But it had more meaning than being part of the Zauber movement. First of all, it represents music, which is totally appropriate for Mozart. But beyond that, it also represents the four elements, which were crucial to the Masonic beliefs, or not crucial, central perhaps, because Pamina at the very end, when she comes in the final trials to go through the trials with Tamino so that she will be with him side by side, she tells him that the flute was made by her father from a 1,000-year-old oak tree, and it represents the four elements because it is made of wood. It is played with the breath, which is air. It was formed during thunder and lightning, which is fire. So all of the elements are tied up in this one instrument. It's given to him as a magical talisman, if you like, to protect him. And it does. Whenever the going gets tough for Tamino, he takes out his magic flute and he plays it. And at this point, he is being tested. The opera is about the trials that both young people have to go through in order to become part of the, really, of the Masonic movement, or to be the enlightened leaders of the new society. But at this point, he's feeling a little alone. He's been told he may not speak, so he takes out the magic flute and he plays it.
Nicht ein Zaubertum, weil holde Flüte, du musst ein Spielen, selbst wilde Tiere Freude fühlen. Wie stark ist nicht ein Zaubertum, weil holde Flüte musst ein Spielen. Holde Flüte musst ein Spielen, selbst wilde Tiere Freude. Doch nur Pamina, nur Pamina bleibt davon, nur Pamina bleibt davon. Pamina, Pamina, höre mich.
dich. Ach, das ist Papagenos Ton. Vielleicht sei er kommen schon, vielleicht kann sie mit ihm zu mir.
So in that you heard the answering bells from Papageno, who is looking for Tamino at this time, as the two instruments speak to one another.
Right. And you know, this is an opera where if you follow the story, which you can easily do by reading the subtitles in front of you, which mm-hmm. is great at the opera, as we've talked about, it's great. But if you just listen to it and look at it as spectacle, that works too.
Exactly. There are many ways of approaching opera. You could know the story and know all of that when you get to the theater. In some cases, you really should, are well advised
some you
to
need
do
to.
That.
La Traviata.
Yeah, exactly, because of the setting, the time, the extraordinary relationships. But with this, no, it's like a pantomime. You can just go yeah. and enjoy it. When he plays the bells at one point, Papageno plays his magic bells, and all of the bad guys dance. They're entranced. They have to dance. It's always a high point of the piece. Another point, the animals are there, and the animals are moving about and dancing as well. So there's a lot of fantasy. I mean, this is a fantasy opera. It's very accessible. It's great fun.
Now, I want to take a little interlude right now for people who've never been to the opera before, and they've bought a pair of tickets or they're thinking about buying a pair of tickets. What can you expect?
Well, there's a lot going on at the opera. First of all, the theater in and of itself is a quite spectacularly lovely place. And most nights you have wonderful sunsets. So it's very advisable to go early. You get your car in the car park up near the front.
Well, and everybody has picnics off of the back of their car.
Exactly. And this is a tradition for opening night, that everybody goes in full evening dress and has dinner off the back of a truck, you know, with champagne
cut glass. That's so New Mexico.
It's so New Mexico. It's great fun. People go up very early and it's great fun. But on most nights, you know, some people will go up and if it's a lovely evening, bring dinner and have dinner in the car park. I mean, that's a fun thing to do. Or if you are 2 hours before curtain, you can go to the prelude talks. There are prelude talks in Stearin Hall, 2 hours and 1 hour before the performance. These are free to people who have theater tickets for that night. That gives you some background and introduction. Or you can come to where I hang out, which is at the Florence Dapples Pavilion, which used to be always called the Cantina. Actually, the Cantina is a magical place, too. It was literally the cantina of the original ranch. And then in the early days, everyone would meet there. And today, throughout the rehearsal period, directors, singers, stage crew, everybody meets and they have lunch and their meals in the cantina. And then in the evening, they put tablecloths on the tables and they charge for dinner. And you can have a lovely al fresco dinner with wine. And I come up with dessert and give some notes on the piece.
So if you haven't, ladies and gentlemen, already memorized everything that's Desiree has said in our talk so far, you can go up for one of those talks.
Yes, you can. And to come to the preview buffet, you should buy your tickets for that when you buy your tickets for the performance. And there's another new sort of innovative idea. Now, you can buy picnic suppers. There are great menus available that you can buy up in the opera grounds and have your own picnic supper. You don't have to cater yourself. So that's quite fun. Now, how do you get there? Some people I know, especially from Albuquerque, don't want to drive back at midnight because these operas end late and you are so carried away by the wonderful opera you may not know where you're going.
You may be driving under the influence of opera.
Yeah, you might be. So for those people, you can take a shuttle bus. I think this is a marvelous idea. There are round-trip shuttle buses from Albuquerque and from Santa Fe. Some of them will get you in early enough to go to the preview buffet if you want to do that. All you have to do is call the box office and order your place online at 48 hours, 2 days in advance of the opera you're going to. So those are nice things to do. But do come early. I think it's such a shame if you rush to the opera
right. And
you're still in the day. And you need to leave all the day's cares behind you in the car park so that by the time you've walked around the grounds, enjoyed the sunset, all the spectacular storms. I mean, I have lectured up there in thunder and lightning. That's quite scary. And people hang in there. You know, they wait for the storm to pass. It can be very exciting. And then you enjoy the performance in this spectacular setting, and you're more prepared. You'll enjoy it much more. Don't rush in. Leave your life in the car park.
And I can also tell you from experience, if it looks like the night is going to be a cold one, bring some warm clothes.
Yes, yes. I usually wear a long skirt with mountain boots. It looks like I leave El Dorado in sunshine. There's a major storm at the opera. Yeah. So, yeah, bring layers. Definitely bring layers. It's more comfortable. But you will stay dry. You don't get wet now in that theater. So that's good.
And as we talked about at the beginning, but I want to also mention again, Desiree Mays, is the author of Opera Unveiled. It's in its 12th year. You've been doing this for 12 years.
It's amazing. Yeah.
Researching. And here with this opera, The Magic Flute, that was performed, 3 years ago, I think?
2006 we did it.
Four years ago.
Yes.
And so you have written...
That's a challenge.
Another chapter, which isn't... You didn't just lift the last one out.
No.
You thought about the whole thing all over again.
Yeah. In the first time round, I really treated this as a Masonic opera. There is a book out there by Jacques Chailly called The Magic Flute, a Masonic Opera, that if anyone's interested in that, buy it. It's riveting reading. I mean, it's definitely there. And now this time I've treated it much more lightly. I see Mozart at home with his 7-year-old boy while his wife is having the baby. And they're making up songs together. I mean, silly things happen. Yeah. At one point, Papageno is playing the Glockenspiel, on stage, and Mozart is in the wings. And apparently, Schikaneder, who played Papageno, used to mime playing the Glockenspiel, and someone played it in the pit. At this performance, Mozart decided to play the Glockenspiel, and he played something completely different just to throw Papageno, which he did, who turned around to the wings and yelled at him, "Shut up." So, you know, silly things that happened in theatre happened then too. So there's two arias I'd love to play at this point that are really contrasting. One is the famous Queen of the Night aria, where she comes to her daughter and she tells her she must kill Zarastro because she wants the symbol of power that Zarastro has that she wants. She is really the evil queen of darkness at this point. And she orders Pamina, her daughter, she gives her a knife and she says, "You must kill Zarastro," which, of course, Pamina is not about to do. But this is a coloratura soprano in full voice. She's very angry. She comes out of the night sky with thunder and lightning. And if you're lucky at the Santa Fe Opera, you'll get thunder and lightning at this point. That happens. So let's hear the Holleracht aria by the Queen of the Night, sung by Mary Dunleavy in this recording.
Oh,
that's the great queen of the night, aria.
Right. And that one, I was thinking, why is it so familiar? Well, it's because I've seen the Magic Flute, but also that was in Amadeus.
That's right. It's one of the key pieces of Amadeus. It's a great test for a coloratura soprano because you really have to be up off into the ether and you'll be able to have to really hit those notes.
Yeah.
You sit on the edge of your seat hoping for the best, and it is so thrilling. It's so thrilling when it happens, and it happens so well in this performance. I think that's why I chose that one. Now, to contrast that, this is the Queen of the Night, who was the bereaved mother, apparently, but is really the bad queen who wants power. She's not really interested in what happens to her daughter. And she has painted Zarastro as the bad guy, but in fact, he is the noble leader of the temple. He is the one who has Tamino and Pamina go through the various trials. They are separated at one point. It's part of their testing, but they are made for each other. And as you pointed out, it was love at first sight, and they will get back together at the end. But at this point, he sings. Pamina is desperate. Her mother disappears into the black night after this aria. And Sarastro comes to comfort her. And he preaches, if you like, at this point, this lovely aria, in diesem Heiligen Hallen, the tenets of the Masonic beliefs. To rule by hate and vengeance is not our practice here. And if a man's repentant, he's saved by love, not fear. If he has lost a loving hand, shows him with joy our happy land. Here peace and mercy govern, by love alone we live. Though tyrants rage and threaten, we love them and forgive. If man can't learn what love can do, his days on earth are surely few. The sort of rhyming, too. You notice the way this is written. So let's hear this, and it's sung by the great singer Kurt Moll. So that gives you a little sense of what Zarastro is about.
And those nice,
temple.
Beautiful, deep voices.
Yes, yes, absolutely. A wonderful bass role here. So this is one of Mozart's greats that can work on many levels. And maybe to finish, we should play part of the finale. Mozart was known for his extraordinary finales, the way he brings everyone together in these ensembles. They're very exciting. They can totally wrap the story. In this case, Pamina and Tamino are united together by Sarastro. And Sarastro was modeled on the head person of the lodge in Vienna, Baron von Born, who believed in these tenets and who was a man, again, who believed in the ideals of the Enlightenment and was moving forward in that direction. But sadly, he died before the premiere, so he didn't get to see the opera. But there's a real sense of resolution and of moving forward, and at different levels. Tamino and Pamino are the noble, the royal couple, if you like, definitely the noble couple, whereas Papageno and Papagena, his little wife, are the simple people, and you don't have to be a hero. You don't have to be the leader to make up the society. I think that's what he is coming across here, that it takes all kinds of people, and all are happy at the end. All their needs are met, and it all comes together in the great finale.
There is an author who is writing about how in every tragedy, it's only a couple of characters who suffer a tragic fate. Everybody else goes back to their lives in one way or another, and it's important to remember that.
That's true, and that definitely happens in Don Giovanni. Don Giovanni is dragged off to hell, and then all of the other characters come down to the footlights, and they all get on with their lives.
Right.
You know, Leporello, his servant, goes to the nearest bar to find another master. The others go home for supper. I mean, they do very mundane, ordinary things, and just close the chapter on the tragedy. I mean, life does go on, it turns out.
Now, we're going to hear the finale, and one of the things, I mean, we play a lot of arias, and that's fine, but some of these ensemble pieces are so beautiful with the many voices.
They are, and that's a great strength here of the Santa Fe Company, too, that our young singers who are chosen from all over the world, I mean, thousands literally audition to get these few slots in the season here. Their experience here is incredible. They are exposed to the best directors, conductors, and coaches right, left, and center. In fact, they also audition while they're here. If they can get into the Santa Fe Apprentice Program, they have the opportunity to audition for general directors from other houses who may give them work. I mean, a number of get work. And I must say, Charles McKay and Richard Gaddis before him have this gift of choosing the next generation of singers.
Yeah.
We get them, and then they go to all, they win the big competitions, go to the Met. And if we're lucky, we've contracted them 2 or 3 years down the road, so we get them back. That
and
happens
some of
a lot.
Them, yeah, and some of them are understudies to major roles, and if that person gets sick or something happens, that happened 2 years ago, one of the apprentices stepped into a role in Falstaff.
Opposite David Daniels in one opera. I mean, that was a major undertaking, a young singer from Albuquerque, it turned out.
Yeah.
So that was exciting. In our production here, the conductor is Lawrence Rennes and the director, Tim Aubrey. This is the production that we did before. And it's interesting that Tamino, who will be sung on one of these performances, is Alex Schrader, who will be singing Albert Herring.
Oh, right.
And then we have different singers. Sometimes the roles are shared because of their calendars. It doesn't always work out that they can do the entire season. So, for instance, we have two Queens of the Night, one for July and one for August, it turns out. So this is a fun piece. It's a good family piece. If you've never been to an opera, it's a good first.
And there are, of course, nights where they have school groups that come up, too, and that's great because
yeah.
You have all these young people from schools around New Mexico.
That's right. There are three youth nights. We haven't talked about those, and we should. These are three final dress rehearsals where parents can take two to however many kids you want at a vastly reduced rate. You pay very little for this, and it's really fun. One night, for instance, is a Pueblo night, and the Pueblo families come with their wonderful blankets. And, you know, Pueblo kids get so much out of opera because they are quite familiar with dance, with music, with drumming, with masks, in a way our kids are really not. It's fascinating to watch that audience. And the house filled with 2,000 young people. I remember talking to a Carmen once, and she said, you know, for me, that final dress rehearsal was the most important performance because that was the one with our new generation of audience members,
right,
with the kids. They laugh in different places, but that's okay. You know, it's okay. So, yes, the youth nights, and that's something else you can find out about at santafeopera.org.
So let's hear the finale to The Magic Flute.
Die Strahlen. Sonne vertreiben die Nacht. Wenn ich Hände heugne, ich
Applause is appropriate, right?
Yes, indeed. So, the magic flute. Desiree, it's been great being with you once again today.
Thanks so much, Marie-Charlotte. It's always fun.
Desiree Mays is the author of Opera Unveiled and the nightly lecturer at the opera's Preview Buffet. You can find them on the web at santafeopera.org, and their number is 505-986-5900. Once again, this week, the Santa Fe Opera is doing a different opera every night, so on the Radio Cafe, we're running our opera series with Desiree Mays, talking about the opera that's on stage tonight. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Many thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.